Welcome back to the program. The China we're all too familiar with today is a modern nation moving rapidly from a rural to an industrial economy, a center of commerce and modernity. But just before World War II, China, particularly Peking, as it was known then, was a colonial outpost, a mix of privilege, scandal, superstition, and opulence. The British were everywhere. The Japanese were encircling the city. It was truly the last days of the old Peking. Amidst this, a murder of a British schoolgirl would capture the city's imagination and fear, a murder that would reveal a side of the city that few wanted to acknowledge and that was also seeing its last days. China expert and expat Paul French has picked up the threads of this story and woven them into a remarkable picture of a time that was a true prelude to modern China. Paul French is the founder of the market research company Access Asia. He's a China specialist and has been quoted in a wide variety of publications, including the Financial Times, Newsweek, and the Wall Street Journal Asia. He studied history and economics in London and has a Master of Philosophy in Economics from the University of Glasgow. It is my pleasure to welcome Paul French to talk about his latest book, Midnight in Peking: How the Murder of a Young Englishwoman Haunted the Last Days of Old China. Paul French, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Delight to have you here. First of all, how did you stumble upon this story of this murder that took place in 1937?
Well, there's an American connection there, actually, because I was reading a biography of Edgar Snow, the American journalist who escaped the Depression and went to China in the 1930s. And became very well known for writing a book called Red Star Over China, which was really the first book that introduced Chairman Mao and the Communist Party of China to a Western audience, which is interesting. But there was one footnote in this book that said that Edgar Snow and his wife, Helen Foster Snow, lived on a traditional street in Peking called a hutong, as they're called, and they were next-door neighbors to a British family called the Werners. Edward Werner, the father, was a former British diplomat. His daughter, Pamela, was 19 years old, and in January 1937, she was murdered and quite severely mutilated, and her body was dumped, and it was a murder that was never, ever solved. And I thought, oh, that's quite interesting. I might have a little dig around on that and see if there's anything there.
And as you started to investigate this, it took you to a number of strange places, places that in 1937 people didn't want to know about, didn't want to uncover.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to remember, Peking, you know, what's now, of course, this massive city of Beijing, but it was still a big city in 1937 with 3 million people, but only 3,000 of those were foreigners. And they were split into two distinct groups. One mostly lived in an area called the Legation Quarter, which had European architecture, European boulevard-type streets, the only electric streetlights in Peking. And they were the diplomats, they were the journalists, the businessmen, the professional people. Next door to them, almost in the Chinese city, was an area that became known as the Badlands in the 1930s. And that was mostly occupied by what we used to call the White Russians, people who had come out of Russia in 1917 to escape the Bolshevik Revolution, found themselves with not a lot of skills, and fell into often petty crime, prostitution, drug dealing, and so on. And also there were just this multinational group of ne'er-do-wells and what used to be called driftwood, who were just people who just had reasons to disappear to the edge of the world and involve themselves in crime. Now, the two worlds would like to think of themselves as being very, very different. What immediately the investigation of Pamela Werner's murder revealed was that these two worlds overlapped much more than anybody would be comfortable with.
There was also the sense that the murder, and this is part of why, as you write about it, captured the imagination of a lot of people, is that it seemed to presage some of the things that were happening in China.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think every so often a murder comes along or an event so horrible comes along that it grabs the zeitgeist. It gets the mood of the moment. January in 1937... Peking in January 1937 was a city on the edge. The Japanese had completely surrounded the city. They were camped at the Marco Polo Bridge, just 8 miles from the Forbidden City. It was no longer really a question of if Japan was going to invade China. It was simply a question of when. So the fear, the panic, the terror in Peking among everyone, foreigners and Chinese, was at an all-time high. And then along comes this murder, a young, beautiful 19-year-old English girl from a privileged background, the sort of person that nothing bad is ever supposed to happen to. And she is murdered, she is mutilated, she is dumped on waste ground, and no one can find out who did it. And she became just a symbol for this impending, as you say, presaged this collapse for China from civilization into barbarism and war.
Part of it also was where the body was found by this fox tower that had this weird spiritual sense about it.
Yeah, the fox tower. The fox tower is still there in Beijing. You can go and see it. Of course, the original wall around the Forbidden City, the imperial city of Beijing, had four watchtowers. Now, there's only one left, and that happens to be the one that is the Fox Tower. And just outside of that Fox Tower were all the graveyards of Peking. No one except a member of the royal family was allowed to be buried within the walls of Peking. So all the graveyards are outside. Now, foxes and fox spirits in Chinese, but also Korean and Japanese culture, are slightly different to foxes in Western culture. They are shapeshifters, and they live in graveyards. And foxes take the form of beautiful women. And they come into the city, and they look for weaker and less intelligent beings, which in this case would be men, actually. And they lure them with their beauty and singing and wine, and then they extract their yin and their yang. The fox spirit lives for 10,000 years. You're dead. That's what they do. And so when Pamela was found at the Fox Tower, there were superstitions among many of the older Chinese there that she was a fox spirit who had been defeated, that the fox spirits were alive and about. So there was also this, as well as this serious investigation going on into the sort of white mischief and the badlands of Peking, there was also this rumor going around that fox spirits were about. Again, a kind of an end of times, the sort of thing that happens when you know that bad stuff is about to happen.
The other thing that gives this story its kind of cinematic quality in some respects is the clash of cultures within the context of the investigation, how this chief Chinese detective had paired up with this ex-Scotland Yard detective to investigate this crime.
Yeah, I mean, that piqued my interest very early on. And as far as I know, it's a unique collaboration. Of course, Peking is Chinese soil, so the chief of the Peking Detective Bureau, a man called Colonel Han, was assigned the case. He was a very urbane, very well-trained, very experienced detective who spoke English. He had dealt with a lot of murders in Peking. But it so happened that there was a British detective stationed in Tianjin, not far away, who was an ex-Scotland Yard detective. And because Pamela was the daughter of a senior British diplomat in China, because of the political tensions in the city and the need to kind of solve this crime and the horror of this crime, the two men worked together. So it was it's the only time that I know of that someone... You know, that a Chinese detective and a British detective, both extreme professionals at what they were doing, and had ever worked together.
You talk about three primary suspects originally, including the father.
Well, you know, detectives then, as now, just run the statistics, right? And I mean, apart from times of war or sort of, I don't know, drug dealers shooting each other or something, most people are murdered by people they know. You know, most murders are husbands murdering wives or wives murdering husbands or lovers murdering lovers. You know, you don't normally get killed by someone you don't know, I have to tell you. And so, of course, you know, they looked at the father.
And also the headmaster of the school where she was going.
Well, the problem with this case from the start, which was very worrying to the British government in China at the time, was that what it immediately did, as murder investigations tend to do, it just lifted the lid off of everything. And, you know, there was this supposedly polite, respectable foreign society, and all of a sudden, all the scandals and all the personal messes came tumbling out, including the fact that there had been a covered-up scandal at Pamela's school, which was a very good grammar school run on British private school lines, among a headmaster who seems to have been a drunk and maybe acted inappropriately towards Pamela and other girls at the school. This was all covered up. Nobody talked about all these sort of things in a very British way, a very 1930s way, and all of this just came pouring out.
And then there's this dentist that becomes a suspect who we find out is leading a kind of double life.
Ah, and he's one of yours. He's an American as well, so the British can't take all the blame for this. Yeah, an American dentist, a graduate of Harvard Dental School, no less, who went to China very early, actually, and became the best known and the most expensive dentist to foreigners in the legation quarter. Had a very nice life, but it turned out that he lived a double life, running various parties at which girls, often prostitutes, were invited to. He rented an old temple in the hills outside Peking during the summer and would sort of have nudist parties up there. And you can imagine what was going on at those sort of things. So this whole sort of secret demi-monde of Peking was suddenly front page news.
And as these two detectives, the Chinese detective, the ex-Scotland Yard detective, as they start to investigate this, talk about little by little the layers of the onion they started to peel back.
Yes, they did. And that, of course, caused trouble. Once they started to do that, people wondered just how far this was going to go, just how many names were going to get dragged into this, otherwise respectable married men, otherwise people in senior positions at various embassies and consulates. And so, you know, there was resistance to the investigation from, among others, and particularly the British diplomats in China.
Talk a little bit about why the investigation ultimately led nowhere.
Well, I mean, ultimately, the detectives, there were a number of reasons they were unable to get places. Number one, a lot of people weren't talking to them. Number two, the British government particularly interfered and did not like the idea. Once it became clear that this was a murder between foreigners, that this was about scandals between foreigners and not a crazy Chinese doing the killing, the British government worried very much about loss of face, loss of prestige in Asia, what with the war coming and everything. It was also true that the science was against the detectives. I mean, you know, they weren't like, they couldn't really do CSI Peking. They didn't have lots of DNA typing and all the rest of it. They just had to go on good old-fashioned clues, and that made life hard. But mostly the fact was that in July 1937, when they were still investigating the murder, the Japanese finally invaded China and occupied Peking. Colonel Han, who was associated with the nationalist government in China, had to disappear very, very quickly. DCI Dennis, the British detective, had to go back to Tianjin, where technically he was employed there in the British concession, because to organize the resistance against the Japanese by the British in Tianjin. So, you know, it just, the investigation ground to a massive and sudden halt, and that was the end of it.
And really didn't begin again until you started your own personal investigation.
Well, you're quite right, and I thought, this book, this is a book without an end, but it's probably still going to be an okay book, because I've got a really good characters, I've got a really good period in history, I've got all the smells and bells and whistles of old Peking. You know, I think this can sort of work with a conclusion that just says, you know, we don't always get to solve murders, it's not like an episode of a TV cop show, it doesn't all get wrapped up 5 minutes before the news and weather. Let's see how that works. And I was in London, I was at the UK's National Archives, which is our sort of Library of Congress, with just all the records of the British government and everything. And I was sifting through boxes and boxes of information, and I came across a document that had been catalogued in 1943, which was 150 pages of notes of a private investigation that Pamela's father, Edward Werner, who had been a long-standing British diplomat in China, had conducted between the Japanese invasion of China in 1937 and December 1941, when, of course, immediately after Pearl Harbor, Britain and America declared war on Japan, and all British and Americans were put in prisoner of war camps by the Japanese if they were still in China. And he managed to get this document out and sent to London. London, to be fair, had other things to worry about when the document arrived, what with the Blitz and beating Hitler and little jobs like that that had to be taken care of. And so it was never read. And of course, you know, as you know, after the war in 1945, China went into civil war. In 1949, Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan. Mao took over. The bamboo curtain came down. And the case just got forgotten.
And as you started to get into this, talk about where it took you, where it started to lead you.
You know, I had always thought that Pamela was 19. She was doing what 19-year-old girls do. She was a girl becoming a woman. With all of the power of a 19-year-old woman in terms of attractiveness and the ability of, you know, to attract the interest of men, wanting to go out and explore, to date, to go to dances, to parties and so on. But, of course, you know, at 19, you have none of the experience. You can't tell the good guys from the bad guys. And that's what gets people into a lot of trouble at that age. I didn't realize that this was going to become a much, much darker story of really quite evil men within the foreign community in Peking, and a story that really had never been told before, because this was really dark stuff and not necessarily very well known. So it was quite surprising to me that what had been all about location and an area, and even 76 years ago, you feel quite a lot of distance there, suddenly became very personal and very nasty, and I really did want to get to the bottom of it at that point.
What did you learn? What did you begin to sense about Pamela's father?
Well, Pamela's father was a very interesting character for me. He was a British diplomat. He was a man of a certain class and education and standing. And he was unemotional. He was quite cold towards Pamela. He left her alone for long periods of time. She was sent away to school in a nearby city, very good school, but she was sent away to a board at a school there. But I wasn't really worried about that, because I felt, everyone always asks me about him in America, but, my only answer to it is, when Americans read the book, they find him to be very cold and unemotional. My only answer to that is, that's what English dads are like. people are quite like that. My father was, so I thought that wouldn't be difficult. When I discovered that, he devoted his entire, the last years of his life, and broke his health and bankrupted himself in this single-minded pursuit of private investigation of trying to find his daughter's killers, I went on a journey of moving from seeing him as a typical cold English father of a certain class to a man who did everything he possibly could to get justice for his daughter, everything he possibly could. And hopefully the reader goes on that journey as well. And in the end, you judge him by his actions, not by necessarily his lack of words and emotions.
And, of course, he couldn't have been comfortable with what he was finding out about his daughter and the world that she inhabited.
Oh, just awful, just awful. I mean, the fact that his daughter was murdered and her body was horrifically mutilated by the killers, as if that wasn't enough. And he stumbled across his daughter's body at the start and had an instant heart attack when he saw what had been done to her, but managed to recover. But to then find out that, his young daughter, who wasn't worried about the war, she wasn't worried about the Japanese, the world situation, She was enjoying herself, finishing school, about to go off to England to university. She was dating. She was going to dances. She was having her first boyfriends and so on. And then all of a sudden, without giving too much away, she is drawn into a situation by men who should have known better and were evil. Now, Pamela may have been staying out a little bit late, not always telling her father, what time she was going to come home and where she'd been, but she certainly did nothing to deserve what happened to her.
Talk a little bit about your attitudes going into your investigation. Did you have any sense of who you thought the suspects were?
I didn't really. I mean, I didn't really know about this world. Of course, I've been reading and writing about China for over 20 years, and this area of the Badlands and the kind of the lower depths, the demimonde of foreign life in China, I really didn't know about. I had a sense of it in Shanghai, where I think we know more about gangsters and criminals that were in Shanghai when it was this great kind of Chicago of China in the 1930s. But I didn't really know about this Badlands area of Peking, and it's very hard to research because these are not diplomats or missionaries or businessmen who all write their memoirs and leave lots of letters and archives. These are people who were in criminal enterprises, who were doing bad things, who had gone to Peking to get lost, and they certainly don't want to leave any traces.
What did this tell you about kind of the afterlife of this, the way this period of time that you really kind of uncovered as you were involved in this investigation, what did it tell you about the residue that leaves today in Beijing?
It's quite amazing, just how much you can still get if you dig around. I mean, it's amazing what's out there. Once you start to put together everything, you look at archives and you come across the old newspapers from the time. I came across the Pamela's autopsy was done in a place called the Peking Union Medical College, which was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. So their archives are still there. The British government's archives. I was here in Washington looking at the Library of Congress archives on the American embassy in Peking at that time. People who you can find who are still alive, which is very, very important if possible, because those are the people who give you the gossip. They tell you what all the kids were saying at school the next day. They tell you what the parents were talking about around the dinner table, They give you that other aspect of things. And this really is the last weeks, the last breath of that old China. As I say, you know, then China goes into the war in 1937. I mean, at that moment when Japan invades China, that is really the Second World War starting. I know as a European, I tend to think of 1939. As an American, maybe you think of Pearl Harbor and 1941 as the start of the Second World War. But it really starts in 1937 with the invasion of China. It's, from that point, there's no going back, really.
And without giving too much away again, do you feel like you've cracked the case?
Well, of course, you know, I'm going to assume all the glory and say that I cracked the case. The truth is, though, to be fair, what I did was I dug around in archives and was diligent enough, to be fair, to find the paperwork that Pamela's father had managed to put together, the evidence that he had got, the evidence that he sent to London. And I've been able to find that, sift through that, cross-reference it with every other piece of paper I can find, every other person I could find who would tell me what was happening at the time, every other newspaper article, and put that all together in a book. So really, this is about bringing to light the investigation that her father did. He solved it.
Paul French, the book is Midnight in Peking, How the Murder of a Young English Woman Haunted the Last Days of Old China. Paul, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
It's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you.